opened up to me like I have never heard her before. Thank you for sharing your story, and I know that there are many others who share your feelings. And to end the show, I have to share a few more Inuktitut words with you. The word kallunaq, 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 white person. The word inuvunga, this means I am Inuk or I am human. Inuvunga, inuvunga, inuvunga. Tukisivunga, I understand. Tukisivunga, tukisivunga, tukisivunga. I am Madeline Alakrelo. Inuvunga, tukisivunga. Nakormik, thank you for listening to this episode of Words and Culture. Atsunai!
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin. Soko seni denit e. Minen yuji hina.
Eko se.
Kakuhutau. We'll see you again.
Hey. Wake up.
How what?
It's noon already. Wake up.
I can't. I didn't sleep much last night.
Why?
I was watching reruns of Project Runway.
Bright lights from electronics block your body's production of melatonin. Keep your sleep area for just that. Sleep. Going screenless at night can help you sleep better, longer. Bring us on. Adults need 7 to 9 hours every night. Do you get it?
This January, the Society of Professional and Graduate Students at Queen's University will hold its annual winter elections and referenda for SGPS student fee collecting groups on January 29th and 30th. The referendum and elections will be held online via Simply Voting. Eligible SGPS students will receive an email from the SGPS at 12:01 a.m. on January 29th with instructions and links to cast their ballots online. Learn more about SGPS elections and referenda at sgps.ca and on Instagram at queenssgps.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Viewpoints on today's show. Black History Month is coming up this February under the theme, All That We Carry.
The uncomfortable truth is that many people have died and fought for me to be here this morning, stand shoulder to shoulder with my brothers and sisters to represent our black community.
Paintings of New Brunswick-born Edward Mitchell Bannister come to Sackville, courtesy of the Smithsonian Museum. The exhibit is entitled Hidden Blackness.
Anthony Blinken said that art encourages us to test our humanity and to connect with others.
The town of Cobourg is rethinking its position on issuing religious declarations, this after being asked to designate a day in March as Atheist Awareness Day.
If you want to open the door to faith-based proclamations, then you've opened it all the way.
In Ontario, the Wilfrid Laurier University kicks off a new Indigenous online course.
This is the history of Canada, and this needs to be taught. Is there so much misinformation out there about Indigenous people?
A Concordia University student attends the COP29 meeting in Azerbaijan and shares his experience with us.
I always thought that COPs weren't amounting to anything, and I thought, oh, might as well go there and see what actually happens there. And so I ended up going out of curiosity, actually.
And a staff salmon hatchery will be built on the north bank of the Nechako River in BC. Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello, thanks for being with us again this week. My name is Boris Chassai, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. So you know that February is BHM in Canada. A motion to recognize the Black History Month across the country was unanimously approved by the House of Commons in 1995. This year's Black History Month, or BHM, will take place under the theme All That We Carry. Speaking at Place des Arts during the launch, the BHM Roundtable shared February slate of programming spanning exhibitions, talks, concerts, social events, and more. They also announced a brand new Black History Book Club, which will this year put the spotlight on 12 community laureates. Jules Bugiel in Montreal, Quebec, met up with Ian Thomas, spokesperson for the 2025 BHM.
I think it's important that everybody should have a duty in the Black community to help out in their own way. We don't all have to be community activists. We don't all have to be workshop facilitators. A small gesture, just like a welcome greeting when you see another Black person, can go a long way. Because the uncomfortable truth is that many people have died and fought for me to be here this morning, stand shoulder to shoulder with my brothers and sisters to represent our Black community. So when Nadia called me, she said, listen, we want you to be spokesperson for Black History Month, I thought it was my time to step up and represent for my culture.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
Lots to do during that month also across the country. In New Brunswick, for example, they are gearing up for the Hidden Blackness exhibit, presenting works by painter Edward Mitchell Bannister. He was born in 1828. He died in 1901. Bannister was a Black artist born in St. Andrews, New Brunswick. He spent most of his adult life in Providence, Rhode Island, where he was also a prominent abolitionist and philanthropist. Hidden Blackness is the first major exhibition of Edward Mitchell Bannister's work ever presented in Canada, 124 years after the artist's death. Conservator Gwen Manthey was in Sackville last week, along with a group of paintings that will be featured in the Hidden Blackness exhibition. Manthey is a painting conservator with the Smithsonian American Art Museum in Washington, D.C. Erica Butler in New Brunswick dropped into the Owens Art Gallery to speak with Manthey to first ask her how she came to care for Bannister's paintings.
We got a lot of works in there through a massive gift, and I became familiar with them because they were regularly used for government loans. That's another loan that we fulfill to federal office buildings in D.C., as well as traveling exhibitions. So a number of these had been prepared for loan, were not chosen, and there was the one work in the gallery. And because those works were not chosen, I was, you know, also had never heard of the artist, I started to look him up. And that's where rabbit holes are formed, if you are somebody that likes to learn. Because he is a fascinating character, and that's why his works are on display here, too. It's simply access and being cognizant and aware of the things that are around you. Anyone who's interested in their profession, there's going to be something that fascinates them that they hadn't heard of. So that's how I came to know Bannister, as well as being introduced to him from other interested scholars. But because I'm entrusted with the care of the collection, I got to spend a bit more time looking than they did.
Tell me a bit about him. He was, well, in addition to, you clearly have a love of his work, but he's also, he's also a very interesting person, and, you know, was an activist, a community, like an upstanding citizen in his community. Tell me a bit about his life.
So what we know is mostly third party, what other people have written about him, as well as receipts, documents, and newspaper articles. After leaving New Brunswick when his family died, he moved to Boston with his older brother, William. Other scholars have told us that he was a longshoreman and he was apprenticed to a cobbler. These are all very tactile, manual labor jobs. But he gets to Boston, where there is a really active abolitionist community. I believe the number was, and I need to double check that again, up to 40% of free Blacks in Boston were barbers. And so he's taking, his ability to work with his hands and taking that into a career that will use the skills that he has, but also introduce him to a vast network of people. Free self-emancipators, other potential artisans, abolitionists, social justice warriors, but then also potential clients, and wealthy white people too. I believe I mentioned in the talk, there's a book where most Black barbers were actually, their clients were white men. And so you've got this interesting duality of a Black man holding a knife to a white man's throat. And how can you get to that point? and that's through developing trust and rapport and conversation. So that's one of his jobs. And then from there, he goes to photographer, and he starts painting these photographs as well. The democratization of the image, a low-cost way of getting your visage, and especially for people who are volunteering to go off to war, that memento is going to be very important. And how do you make something like that even special? Well, you can paint it if you can't afford the gold to put around the case. I believe that he would have fought for the 54th or volunteered in some capacity. This is my own hypothesis. But he had a weak heart, and that might have been from being exposed to photographic chemicals. But he became an artist, and he threw all of his energy into caring for others.
Bannister, I mean, do we know if he was a painter in his youth before he left New Brunswick? Would we have paintings that date from that time? Do you know at all?
Well, we know the watercolors that are going to be on display. And I don't have the provenance on that, but Emily does. These are watercolors he could have made while he's here in New Brunswick. It's the established tradition to become an artist by starting to copy known works. And when you don't have a museum available, you can look to the printed image. Newspapers were probably the most accessible. And so even works of art, when they're reprinted, can be reproduced. As I understand, the Owens Art Gallery itself had a really rich watercolor training program here. So I would love to do more research in the area to see what works in this collection were actually extant and in the areas where Bannister was working. And there is a piece in the Smithsonian American Art Collection known as Dorchester. And I believe it was painted in the 1850s, or that's the date. I have not had my hands on the artwork with enough time to understand why it was called Dorchester, but it could have been misnamed with the assumption that it was from the Massachusetts Boston area and overlooking the Dorchester area near here in Sackville. So it will take some digging in his historic photographs, as well as what are the landmarks available, where are there houses on this rise next to the sea that would have been possible for Bannister to paint in the area. So it is possible, it just takes time, and time is the one resource that you can't create necessarily. So getting other people interested in the project too, I shouldn't say the project, but just interested in Bannister, to help understand and contextualize these paintings is key.
Give me the sales pitch for locals in Sackville,
yeah,
why they should definitely come to the Owens to check out this exhibition.
One of the interesting things about Bannister is you can come from it from many lens points beyond the art. You've got the racial and social politics. You've got the progression of technology and image making throughout his life. You've got the nuanced understanding of what it takes to be a salesperson as well in Bannister. There are many different stories that can be told from individual artworks, be it the hidden composition, the visible composition, what these landscapes mean to the area, but as well as I had mentioned, you know, what brought Bannister's family here, the history of mining, logging, resources from the sea too, and finding those links to the paintings themselves. It's possible for anyone from any background to find something of themselves and some interest in these artworks. And actually, something that I forgot to mention as I started my quote, so I'm happy to repeat it here. I attended something recently where Anthony Blinken, the former United States Secretary of State, commented that, and I do not want to misquote this, Anthony Blinken said that art encourages us to test our humanity and to connect with others. You can use art as that vehicle for conversation, that object-based therapy to start a bigger discussion about what individual priorities are, and even use that landscape to understand how your own personal landscape has changed and whose priorities made it change.
That's Gwen Manthey, a paintings conservator with the Smithsonian American Art Museum in Washington, D.C., who is in Sackville this week, along with paintings for a show opening this Friday at the Owens. Hidden Blackness features the works of Edward Mitchell Bannister, a Black artist born in St. Andrews, New Brunswick, who spent most of his adult life in Providence, Rhode Island, where he was also a prominent abolitionist and philanthropist. Hidden Blackness opens this Friday with a vernissage scheduled for 7 p.m. at the Owens Art Gallery. This is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You are tuned to Viewpoints.
In Ontario, the town of Cobourg is rethinking its position on issuing religious declarations after being asked to designate a day in March as Atheist Awareness Day. Last November, the town passed a controversial motion to proclaim December as a Christian Heritage Month, but a motion by Mayor Lucas Cleveland was passed Thursday at a Cobourg Council Committee meeting to possibly revoke the Christian Heritage Month declaration. This following a presentation by Bob LeDrew, who was denied a request by the council to declare March 23rd as Atheist Awareness Day. LeDrew says while Northumberland County is becoming less religious, the council is not applying its own policy equally. More with Dan Jones in Cobourg, Ontario.
Cobourg Council is now rethinking its November decision to declare December Christian Heritage Month. This decision follows a presentation Thursday by Bob LeDrew at Cobourg Council's Corporate Finance and Legislative Standing Committee. LeDrew requested town staff that council declare March 23rd Atheist Awareness Day. He says his request was denied as the town's flag-raising and proclamation policy does not allow for declarations to be issued for religious organizations or events. LeDrew says he's in support of this policy, but believes it's not being equally followed, as council has now set a precedent on religious declarations.
I'm in strong agreement with that policy, as I think government is best done in a secular fashion. Government should be careful to prevent even the perception that they officially approve or sanction a religious organization or faith. If you want to open the door to faith-based proclamations, then you've opened it all the way. If you want to shut that door, it's up to you to shut that door.
LeDrew explains that Northumberland County is becoming less religious. He cited a 2021 Statistics Canada Religious Diversity Report suggesting that approximately 45% of the county's population has no religious affiliation, up from 25% 10 years ago.
Council acted in conflict with its own policies by issuing a proclamation for Christian Heritage Month. Staff made an incorrect decision to deny Atheism Awareness Day, given that atheism is not a religion. Canada and Northumberland County are increasingly secular, and Christians are a minority of the population.
Mayor Lucas Cleveland stated he agreed with LeDrew's premise in his presentation that the declaration policy is not being followed, but suggested that atheism is a religion.
As someone who studied philosophy and theology, I would argue that atheism is as much faith-based as any other faith, and that you have the faith that there is nothing instead of the faith that there is something. But I agree with your premise here, sir, that perhaps our policy, and I agree with your premise that secular society is the way we should be heading forward.
Cleveland moved a motion to examine the potential to revoke the Christian Heritage Month declaration. Declaration regulations stipulate that once one is made, it is in effect for 5 years. Town Clerk Brent Larmer recommended that council also look into this. Cleveland's motion did pass, and both areas are expected to be discussed further at the January 29th regular council meeting. I'm Dan Jones.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
The Wilfrid Laurier University has begun its rollout of a new free online Indigenous course that is open to the public. The course Introduction to Indigenous Matters is a self-directed course that the university says can be completed in 6 to 8 hours. Dr. Darren Thomas, Associate Vice President of Indigenous Initiatives at Wilfrid Laurier University, says the course focuses on giving individuals an opportunity to learn learn about Indigenous peoples' experiences, history and culture, and to educate people on misconceptions and misinformation surrounding them. Over 600 individuals have signed up for the online course so far, and feedback has been very positive, says Thomas. The university is already hoping to expand and offer more Indigenous courses in the future. Andrew Dow in Oshawakin, Ontario, spoke with Dr. Darren Thomas.
This course came out of a request from the city of Brantford. And just to kind of set this up here, Call 57 from the Calls to Action of the TRC asks all municipal governments to inform employees and make available training and education about the social political history of Canada. And myself as a consultant and working with other cities and municipalities up and down the Grand River. And so the city had actually reached out to us for designing this program and make it available.
Thomas explained that the course focuses on the early history of Canada and looks to educate individuals on that time period to detail the challenges that were faced by Indigenous people.
Many universities across the country do some sort of public education like this. And, you know, I think, you know, especially here in Ontario, what I often joke about, you know, and I mean, it's not a joke in a laughing matter, but what I often tease about is that if you're educated in Ontario, the only little bit of history and knowledge you ever receive is a grade 3 pioneer unit with provincial education. Many provinces across the country, you know, Ontario's kind of in the middle. Some are way far behind, some are way ahead in terms of what we teach about Indigenous people and Indigenous history, and in particular, the settlement history. I think that's where, you know, because that's where you get into all the challenging content and the stuff that, you know, is basically, you know, some of the reasoning why this content isn't available into our school system, because it's an ugly history.
Thomas spoke on the course providing context to the challenges that were faced by Indigenous peoples and his hopes that it can help overcome some of the misconceptions and misinformation surrounding them.
This is the history of Canada, and this needs to be taught, because knowing and understanding the situational context that Indigenous peoples are living in, without unpacking that, you just don't know. And the other side of this, Andy, is there's so much misinformation out there about Indigenous people. We don't pay tax. We get everything for free, house and car and land and all the garbage that's out there in terms of misinformation, that stereotype. This environment of no accurate information and a lot of misinformation creates an environment of a lot of hatred, a lot of anti-Indigenous racism, and of a lot of people just having very little empathy for the lived experiences of Indigenous people. So this course attempts to try to address a lot of high-level stuff about some of the social political history, but also the local history about who Indigenous people are in the neighborhood and along the Grand River. You know, like, we really have to follow the light of the late Senator Sinclair, Justice Sinclair, who led the TRC, and his very famous quote in his time was, education got us into this mess and education is going to get us out. Understanding the social political realities that Indigenous people are continuing to endure, Canadians have to learn that reconciliation has nothing to do with Indigenous people. Reconciliation is about Canadians reconciling with Canadian history.
I'm Andrew Dow, and this news story is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, which supports the creation of original civic journalism.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrim, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints.
University student Jordi Villanova headed a Concordia University delegation and attended the latest COP29 meeting in Baku, Azerbaijan. Jordi Villanova is a PhD student studying biodiversity in Montreal. COP29, as you know, is the United Nations Conference, a massive summit on climate change that is attended by delegates from many countries. Villanova attended the meeting despite his initial hesitation. And after his return, Villanova spoke at a climate cafe on January 21st, a monthly event where locals discuss climate change and solutions at the community level. Journalist Adam Innes caught up with him.
I always thought that COPs weren't amounting to anything, and I thought, oh, might as well go there and see what actually happens there. And so I ended up going out of curiosity, actually, try to understand what's happening there and then try to report back what I saw and why there's misunderstandings about COP.
Villanova attended despite initial hesitation.
Negotiations at COP are extremely important, but not the main thing that's happening there. A lot of the things happening at COP is local level things, more entente between different groups, trying to push for different things. So I really learned that global change is actually happening at a local level, and then we just find ways to make it global. But how we are going to solve climate change is really just pushing these local level initiatives and push them at a global scale. That's the main takeaway that I had from COP.
Villanova says, though he is still skeptical about many aspects of COP, he saw immense value in the networking and discussion that took place there.
I now see more of the value in having people from very, very different political backgrounds sit around the same table.
He was able to discuss his biodiversity work with other delegates. He says at COP he was having educating conversations with other delegates, even about small projects at the local level, discussing things like pollinator gardens and ecological corridors, like the ones here in NDG. He is encouraging that in the community there is more collaboration between groups approaching issues of biodiversity and climate change.
These local level actions are actually having an impact at COP, because people here are learning from all these different people. They are reporting these things back to other organizations that can go to these events. So local level actions are being seen at this international scale. So in NDG, it's extremely important, any action that's being done, because it's trickling up, it's going up, and it's having an impact, even though we don't see it.
I'm Adam Innes.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. radio@frequencynews.ca.
And finally to British Columbia now, where the Lheidli T'enneh Nation and the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, the DFO, have partnered up to build a fully staffed hatchery on the north bank of the Nechako River near the confluence of the Nechako and the Fraser Valley watershed. This will be one of three facilities built along the Fraser Valley watershed to support salmon populations through the Pacific Salmon Strategy Initiative. Adam Silverstein, Regional Manager of Hatchery Reform and Modernization at the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, spoke with Ian Gregg in Prince George, British Columbia, about the project.
We've worked with the Upper Fraser Fisheries Conservation Alliance and First Nations and Indigenous governments all across the watershed for many years to identify potentially suitable locations for a hatchery. There's lots of different requirements that play into that. Access to the fish populations, the right kinds and quality and quantity of both groundwater and surface water, access to service center and appointment and response times, because these are 24/7, 365 day operations. So all of those things combine and have made it quite challenging in terms of site selection. And we're fortunate that we've been able to identify this site that has access to significant quantities of groundwater and surface water and is located close to the center of Prince George. So that will allow us to be able to travel to the different watersheds to collect gametes for the hatchery and to release the juvenile fish when they're ready to go back to their native watershed. And it allows us to be in a service center where we can access staffing and other needs of a facility like this. But most importantly, it's close to the river and it's got the right quantity and quality of water that we need.
Locally, salmon have significant cultural
cultural, social, and ecological importance. The Kaili Today Nation has been dependent on salmon for generations, but as of late, this hasn't been a central factor in annual harvests. In fact, a lot of salmon stocks throughout our province are in serious long-term decline, and without action, some runs are looking like they may disappear entirely. Do you know what kind of shape our region is in?
We are experiencing pretty severe conservation challenges across the watershed. But that being said, there are a big mix of different populations, different species, and they all have different statuses and trends. And so making one broad comment is difficult. But I think there's no doubt that across the watershed, there are a number of populations that are experiencing the challenges you've outlined. We've seen things like heat domes and different landslides and floods and other events that are creating even more challenges for these populations. And so this new facility is one of the key response measures that we are implementing to try to support these populations. And we're doing that in partnership with the Kalaalleq Tene and other First Nations across the watershed because of that cultural importance and the importance of collaboration in terms of getting the right outcome for these fish and for the people that care about them.
So you know that we often have to cut off big chunks of these great conversations between our journalists and their guests. This was the case here with Ian Gregg's interview. Catch up with the rest on frequencynews.ca. And this is how we close our show this week. Thanks to our journalists Ian Gregg, Andrew Dow, Dan Jones, Erica Butler, Adam Innes, and Jules Bugiel. Our national editors are Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm Boris Chassaigne, your host and producer. Thanks to you for keeping us company this week, and until the next, ciao.
How's it going, guys? On this week on Plugged in My Ears, I'm James, guest on the podcast. I'm here with Sam, Kyle, and Adam, and we're here to have an awesome week talking hockey. We're going to be starting out just chatting. We just watched the Vancouver game on Saturday. Quinn Hughes absolutely popped off, just undressed the Capitals with a crazy backhand goal. And yeah, let's get this going.
Well, I think there's another pressing issue. Adam, I can see he's kind of looking a bit red.
No, let's
over
talk
there.
About the Canucks. Let's
he's steaming. Canucks. Okay,
we'll start with the Canucks. We can
take a depressing turn later on.
Yeah, okay. We'll do that later. But Jim's and I watched that Canucks Capitals game. Quinn Hughes dominated. To no one's surprise, he's has 54 points in 40 games this season, 14 goals, 40 assists. He's plus
12.
Yeah.
Plus 12.
He's, I don't know. He said the other day on the news that he was playing the best hockey of his career, of his life even. And I just, the one thing it makes me think of is that maybe Adam's predictions may come true, that Team USA might win the Four Nations Cup. Like, I know he's a little influenced because he's from Niagara and Fort Erie, and that happens. There's a little bit of American sway there. I'm still not convinced, but I mean, when a guy plays that good, it's hard to disagree. I don't know. What are your thoughts, Mr. Whale?
Okay, I don't think being from Niagara has anything to do with not even supporting the American team, but thinking that they are the best team on paper. But yeah, no, I mean, the players are coming together and they're all playing well right now. I think that they look the best going into the Four Nations. But I mean, I think when we're talking Four Nations, we got to talk about Logan Thompson not being on Canada's team. I mean, he just got a huge contract extension. He's the one of the best goalies in the NHL right now, and he wasn't even invited to like to be one of the top three. Now, I love Sam Montembeau with all my heart, but Logan Thompson is better than Sam Montembeau, and I mean, he's better than Aiden Hill and Jordan Binnington. But I don't know. Yeah. I think the Four Nations is something that like I kind of have had in my back pocket, but I mean, it's coming up closer. How far away are we from it?
It's in 3 weeks. No, it's the first game is going to be 15th or 16th. So
okay, all right,
we're 36 days out essentially.
Okay, perfect.
We're 36 days out, not even. We're 19 days out.
Yeah,
right now, so I thought it was
less than a month.
Yeah,
we're coming up. That's gonna be good. I can't wait to talk about that more because I feel like the NHL All Star break is just like no one really cares. Like last year we were talking about McDavid designing the skills comp and then winning it himself. This one's gonna be a lot more interesting to talk about.
Yeah. It's not corrupt at all.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're kicking themselves not having Logan Thompson of the day for sure. Yeah. 22 wins, .925 save percentage with two shutouts back to back last week. He's been unbelievable. So, I mean, the whole Caps team has just been on fire this entire season. It's great to see, with or without Ovi.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's like now, well, I don't know what the percentage or odds are of him passing Gretzky, but like, I feel like it's got to be close to 90.
He's within
now.
20 goals, isn't he?
Yeah. I think he's going to get goals.
He could get that this year. There's over 40
I don't
games
think
left.
I don't think he'll get it.
It's more if he gets it in less games than Gretzky. I think there's no question in anyone's mind that he's going to get it.
Yeah.
But, you know.
But I know
broken leg doesn't seem to slow him down too much, so it's hard to imagine anything stopping him from getting that record.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But at the beginning of the season, people didn't think it was going to happen this year. I mean, maybe in the next 2 years. But the way the Capitals have been cooking, the way he started playing at the beginning of the year, I think is really commendable, really, really just surprising, honestly. But, I mean, should we really have been surprised? It's Alex Ovechkin. He's one of the best hockey players, if not the best hockey player of the 2010s.
I think his team got better. That helped him a lot. No doubt. I will say, I think the goaltending thing, I think also the Caps have some pretty good defense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's been playing a part. You know, they got Chychrun for a bag of pucks, so it helps when you get some freebies like that in there.
Yeah, agreed. Watching that Caps-Vancouver game on Saturday night, just watching Chychrun skate too. And knowing these boys are Ottawa fans just, you know, hurts the heart a little bit. But at the end of the day, yeah, he's a great defenseman. And, that's definitely not hurting on their blue line there.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see if they're going to make some big moves at the trade deadline. Like, if they're actually going to go for a push. But
the Caps?
Yeah.
I think they will. Why shouldn't they? Like, they got some guys who are expendable they can get rid of and bring in some other good players. I think they're going to be a big selling team.
But this...
Or a big buying team.
Yeah, but I'm saying, like, that's putting all your chips. Like, you know, Ovi's going to retire not that long, like, in the near future. Mm-hmm. And then they'll probably have to sell some decent pieces to make something happen in the trade deadline. So, I mean, yes, maybe they'll do one final hurrah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, they could. I mean, the thing is, though, they're not actually that badly placed. When I think about their roster, like they have a pretty solid first, second line, and their third and fourth line actually kind of play like it's kind of like having two third lines. It's pretty interchangeable.
Mm.
The only thing I think they're lacking is defensive zone structure. Mm. Otherwise, they're really good, but the only reason why Quinn Hughes scored those two goals is because Washington just could not keep track of who was in front of the net. They're both goals that were scored because the defenseman could not box people out from front of the net.
I think
that's the most critical thing in the NHL. Like, even like I'm not that good at hockey, but if there's a screen, I can pretty much score as long as the goalie doesn't see where I'm shooting from.
Yeah, I mean, I think Quinn Hughes is just doing his own thing, though. I mean, I saw some I can't remember the stats off my head, but if you look at the advanced analytics on Quinn Hughes, they're pretty ridiculous. Like,
they're close to Lane Hudson stats.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I saw someone that was messing with Lane Hudson actually at a Montreal game. they had this like big poster, and it was a photo of Connor McDavid, and it was like in a bedroom with all these photos of Lane Hudson everywhere.
Yeah,
it's like Connor McDavid's been dreaming about his idol.
Oh, or man, something. That's good.
they got Lane Hudson to start laughing at it on the ice.
Oh, he's an absolute orchard. Lots of apples to see. Love to see it.
Man. Should we discuss some power rankings before we bring out the tiers?
I want to talk about one thing about the trade deadline. Take for you guys. I want your opinion on it. But have we seen the biggest trade of the year with the Mikko Rantanen trade?
Oh my God.
I don't think anything can top this at the trade deadline. I don't see it. Marner's not getting
something's
traded.
Happening.
No, Marner's going to resign somehow.
You think?
Yeah.
They're pushing it late, weirdly, but I mean, I don't know.
Like, I think this is one of the biggest trades. I don't know if you can consider it a deadline deal since it's really happened so a while before. I think it's like probably one of the biggest mid-season trades I've seen such star players. I mean, I even consider Taylor Hall still a good quality player, and the fact that he was an afterthought in this trade was like surprise.
Taylor Hall has fallen off a cliff, but at the same time, Rantanen for sure, like getting traded, like that's absolutely insane. It'll be really interesting to see him on Carolina.
Yeah, I'll just say this. I don't really think we can say Taylor Hall fell off a cliff, like on a separate note, because I don't know if he ever climbed the cliff in the first place.
He's MVP.
I think he took a chairlift up a ski hill once and then took the green hill down. You know, when I used to play hockey, the Calgary Flames head coach ran a camp in Ottawa. Mm-hmm. And every summer he told me Taylor Hall is about to have his breakout year. And then after 5 years, he's like, yeah, there's no breakout year for Taylor Hall. But separately, like, I don't know. I think this just says a lot about who Mikko Rantanen is as a player, though. These guys didn't even want to bargain with him. They just thought, this is a waste of our time. Screw this guy. So, like, yeah, this is a crazy trade, but I can't imagine. Like, this just gives me the impression that Renton's actually just a pain to deal with in the locker room.
Yeah. I think his mind was made. I think that was the issue. But the thing that's brutal is, like, they didn't really get much for him, to be honest, because it was kind of this one of those trades where he, like, has to be moved, and there aren't that many teams that are going to fork up huge deals because, like, he's moving no matter what, so it kind of means the team trading him just got nothing. Like, you would have hoped they would have gotten some big pieces for that, but barely anything. I'm not even sure I understand why Chicago was in on that deal, but
Chicago just wants to,
they're retaining 50% of his salary. Like,
I actually don't understand why they did that.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, Chicago's in a bit of a weird spot. Maybe somehow they thought that was gonna let them open up something else, but I think it's actually just gonna inhibit them more than anything else.
Yeah.
Although they definitely have a lot of cap space right now. Like, who are they paying big?
They have a lot of cap space. I mean, another thing I was saying is, like, man, if the Carolina Hurricanes don't do something this year, they never are going to. That is, like, the ultimate gift. Like, you know, a franchise player falls out of the sky and onto your first line. You can't dream of something better than that. And at a discount, you know, like, that's actually ridiculous. I mean, if they don't win at least like the conference finals, I don't know what they're doing, but
yeah, no, I agree. They've looked good for a while, but now this is definitely their opportunity. It'll be interesting to see, because they got Gensel for a little bit.
Gensel
obviously left. Yeah, he's really good with them. Now he's obviously on Tampa, but yeah, they got some crazy guys. They got like a lot of depth, so we'll see what happens. I think I'm excited to see Rantanen and play with like Aho. Nietzsche has had like an insane start to the season. He's fallen off a little, but he kind of showed his potential to just like be a really, really big force offensively.
Nietzsche is the one that moved. Mm-hmm. They moved him. He's on Colorado.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Which I think is something that is very cool too, because I think Nathan MacKinnon is going to play well with Marty Nietzsche. I think that him coming over to Colorado is going to do all right. Colorado's still in the heat of a playoff race. Like, they're good still.
They beat the Jets last year when the Jets were like popping. Obviously, that was a bad performance for them, but that's what I'm saying. Colorado is always dangerous. When you have two of the best players in the world in Makar and MacKinnon, like, they always have a shot. And Sammy Girard, I think, can skate as well. So
yeah, I just think the problem is that their depth scoring is definitely going to have to show up if they want to do anything, because they just lost a decent bit of scoring power there. So I mean, and their power play and everything. I mean, with Natchez, hopefully he can make it work. But
Rantanen is also such a physical presence, too. He's just a huge dude. He
consistent.
Yeah, consistent, and he brings, like, a really big physical presence to the ice. So I do think it's a big loss for Colorado. And it's going to be hard to fill that gap. It's definitely going to be a hole that they feel. They got the choo-choo train out there, Nichushkin. You never know what can happen. That man can tip the puck, and he's always getting fired up out there, so he can be dangerous.
Big time. I'm just looking at the Montreal Canadiens power rankings here, so maybe we'll talk about the Montreal Canadiens power rankings. I don't want to say too much because this is kind of one of the highlights of your week, unfortunately, with the somber news of yesterday. But would you like to take it away, my dear friend?
Yeah, okay. Montreal has been placed in the top 16, the Super 16, the NHL calls it, their top 16 teams for the power rankings for the week. And it's the first time that they've been in the Super 16 since 2021, maybe, like since they made it to the Cup Finals.
Before Bedard. That's crazy, BB.
I mean, before Slafkovsky. But yeah, so this is crazy because they're kind of on a bit of a heater right now. They're playing really well. Caulfield is one of the best goal scorers in the NHL.
He's
second in American goal scorers and not on the American team, which is
ridiculous.
A little ridiculous. Only Kyle Connor leads that race. But yeah, I think Montreal's, we kind of talked about them being, they're playing a lot better since the winter break. So I'm excited to see what the future holds. But I think we talked about it last time. Like, I'm not too worried if they miss the playoffs. I'm not really too worried. I think that the season's already been a little bit of a success, showing that like they can go on streaks like this and it's actually consistent winning and not just like two wins and then five losses, or like three wins and five losses. It's like a consistent winning mentality that the team seems to have. You're getting solid goaltending. Defense is all right, but the offense has like really been buzzing, and they've been beating really good teams. I mean, they beat Dallas and then lost to them by one goal. Like, the games have been close, other than the Leafs game, which is a
beat 7-3 in overtime.
Blow. Yeah,
a couple of Fridays ago, they got that overtime win. Suzuki somehow got it over, like, on the backhand. But they just look good. Like, you watch them, they got a lot of explosiveness. Like, obviously, they got some good goal scorers. Is Laine playing right now? He's been kind of back, and he's been back and forth. I think one of the other pods we were kind of joking about him being point per game or goal per game.
Yeah.
And he's not doing terribly on that pace. He's been scoring a ton. He had that Hattie on the power play, bro.
Yeah.
I literally watched that highlight like six times in a row. It was just so nasty. He's just like in that spot in his kitchen. He just knows how to shoot the puck unbelievably well. You can say what you want about his work ethic. It's probably not great, but he can shoot. Oh my God.
I mean, he's transformed that power play. Like, that power play has gone from like low 20s in the league to top 15 power play.
That's probably why they're winning, though, because as I said, like,
that's impressive.
Special teams win. Like, that's just how it is. Like, if you have bad special teams, you're never gonna go anywhere.
Yeah, he's just on. He's 18 points in 21 games this season, and really,
how many goals on that?
12.
Oh, that's pretty good.
12 goals in 18 games is pretty good. That's a good pace. That's a pace that I'm happy with. I hope that the Habs re-sign him. I hope that he maybe stays on a little bit of a discount. I was thinking him and Mikko Rantanen are gonna be in Montreal for the Four Nations. Holy. Maybe they'll be roommates or something, and Patrick will show Mikko the Montreal nightlife or something like that, and Mikko will fall in love, and we live happily ever after. Montreal wins 10 Stanley Cups in a row. That's kind of my plan.
I got one more. Where is Ottawa sitting in those power rankings?
Ottawa was 15th, so right below Montreal, a spot right below.
Right where they belong, a spot below, but a few points ahead in the brackets.
They were talking a bit about Jake Sanderson.
Hmm.
But I mean, nothing too much about the Senators other than like that they are also cooking. They are also playing really good hockey.
But I have to say, I have this like weird, I don't know what it is, but I there's something that there's just about, even though they're winning, I just feel weird about it. Like, I don't like how like they're playing still fully. Like, I'm not fully sold.
I haven't really been keeping up with the teams they've been beating. Have they been good? Like, I think
Tuchuk has had 1 point in 10 games.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's
but they're
cold.
Still winning. So
they've been winning, but they've been winning by small margins. And you know who's been bailing them out is actually the goaltending, weirdly enough. Like,
who's is it Allmark back?
Nope.
Who's playing goal?
Forsberg was in that. Merzlikins.
Merzlikins is on the Senators?
Not Merzlikins. Who's that?
Corpi Salo?
No, it's the another guy with an M, sorry. But
Thad Sogard?
Nope. The Sogard is long gone. Something with an M, but anyways.
When we're watching Forsberg, though, Forsberg has been playing
really well. Forsberg's been good. Yeah. People absolutely torched him.
Yeah.
Last year, but sure. He's been decent. Anyways, I mean they've looked solid.
They've been finding a way to get the dubs. I know what you're saying. Yeah. Not a ton of like really convincing wins.
No, it hasn't. They haven't had like decisive wins. Like yeah. They've kind of just been like
blowouts or something. You know, like
they've been getting a couple ones here and there. Sure. You know, out. Goaltending one game and then kind of
maybe
Merlinen's the
Merlinen,
that's the same thing. Merlinen, same shit.
They're getting scoring from weird places too. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I guess you said Tkachuk has been cold.
He's just been down.
But yeah, Batherson hasn't been producing that much either. Like, so I feel it's like
getting a lot of their offense from the third and fourth.
They haven't been scoring a lot at all.
Yeah,
no, it's been low scoring games for them.
Another stat: they in their last six home games, they only won two.
That was like when I and they that had was like Vancouver as yeah. well.
That's
actually.
Not true. In the last 11, they won 8.
What? That's a couple
of home games.
Last 11.
All of the Senators. Their last 11 home games. They
against
won
the Leafs that night, they had that.
Sorry, I misheard what you said.
They had a stat on the board and it said that they'd previous to beating the Leafs, they had lost. They'd only won 1 out of 5 games, and they had a -20 differential in their home games. So, yeah. That's interesting.
I think the season's looking up for both Ottawa and Montreal.
Yeah.
Can't say the same.
Well, no, let's put this in the context here. Ladies and gentlemen, anytime one dreams, they must dare fail as well. Every empire that has a beginning must also have an end. Yesterday may not have been the beginning of the end or even the end of the beginning, but the Bills lost to the Chiefs. And this is where we're at today. So that's why we've been trying to avoid this topic of conversation. Adam's in tears already.
Yeah. I feel like I'm having like literal deja vu right now, actually, because we had the same exact conversation last year.
Yeah. It's an episode for this really bad sitcom.
We're just waiting for Return of the Jedi.
It was so tough to watch. It was such a good year for the Bills, too. They crushed the Chiefs in the regular season. They didn't blow them out point wise, but they were the better team. They won by about 2 touchdowns, which is like that's a good win. That's a solid win against a team that was undefeated at the time.
Yeah. Substantial.
The only loss, real loss that the Chiefs had this year was to the Bills in the regular season. They lost to Denver in the last game of the year, but they benched all of their starters to save to make sure no one got hurt for the playoffs. I'm fine. Thanks, Sam. I'm going to need something stronger than that. But yeah, so Buffalo goes into the playoffs. They roll through Denver. They beat Baltimore. I was feeling on top of the world. Baltimore was one of the best teams in the NFL this year. I'm like, they're going to beat. This is the year. They're beating the Chiefs. I can tell. I was like, we're definitely not going back to first year. Where there was like a 13 seconds left and the Chiefs came back in and won and forced overtime. That's not going to happen this year. It was going to be different this year. And it's the same old story every year. Every single year. The Chiefs get bailed out by the refs and I'm sick of it. I'm actually sick of it. This is like, you don't see this in any other sport where the commissioner and the league plays favorites. I mean, you can make arguments.
Gary Bettman.
You can make arguments. I mean, Gary Bettman's actually doing us all a favor in retiring. But Roger Goodell, I hate that man. I don't hate very many people. I honestly hate him. I hate the refs. I hate NFL refs. I have never liked NBA refs. I think NBA refs are like the worst refs in sports. But these refs are pretty close second. And only one that's the Chiefs against the Bills. Every other time, you know what? It's okay. And it would have been different if the Bills were getting calls their way. Like maybe it's a 50-50 game. Refs make a bad call for the Chiefs. Then you like make a bad call for the Bills. Kind of like balance it out. Not the case.
No.
Every time, questionable calls, questionable flags thrown, and then picked up. It is very frustrating to watch. I don't know how else to describe it except like a mouse running through a maze and it's almost to the exit. And then it just turns around and goes back into the maze.
Well, yeah.
That's really what it feels like. it's disheartening. I feel bad for the team. I feel bad for all the other fans. I feel bad for the coach. McDermott, the coach, is getting a lot of heat. This time it wasn't his fault. So many times it's been his fault. This time wasn't his fault. This time it was all the Chiefs and the refs against the Bills. Case closed. I hate the Chiefs. You know what? I want the Eagles to crush them. You know, my housemate Josh today said, the only outcome that I want for the Super Bowl is the outcome that happened in Dark Knight Rises, when Bane blows up the football stadium and they are running a kick return, and I just want the game to be over. I want the stadium in New Orleans to implode. I want everyone to be safe, but I want it to implode and only the Chiefs fall down into the hole.
And so everyone's safe except for everyone on the
Chiefs. No, but they survive. They survive. Smith. I'm not condoning death. I think they'll be fine.
No.
But still, I want that stadium to collapse.
The game to just shut down.
I want the Super Bowl to be over. And you know what? When the Chiefs can't play, they call the Bills come up, they play the Eagles. That's my outcome. That's what I'm hoping for. But anyways, I know that's a bit unrealistic.
I mean, I have to say, I saw a lot of things where, like, I mean, I don't really follow football that much, but like stuff like that is not exactly enticing me to start watching it, to be completely honest.
Same.
Well, there were some moments of hope for the Buffalo Bills that game.
Yeah, but I will say, like, in all other sports, like, you know, the NHL's had some brutal calls. Don't get me wrong. Like, there's been some pretty brutal calls, but like, rarely are they like, you know, game shattering calls. Also, it's best of seven, right? So like, there's a bit more opportunity to like make some ground back if you had some bad calls one game. But that being said, I don't think I've ever seen like, you know, three or four like absolutely pivotal calls in like a game seven of a series like that. That was just like imagine you had, you know, three or four goals called back. Mm-hmm. That's basically what happened. Like, you know. That kind of reffing would not fly in the NHL.
But Adam, why is it that the referees are so? I was going to say conservative, but they're actually pretty liberal with the flags they afford. Like, they'll give a lot of flags the second you get close to a guy who looks like or is Patrick Mahomes. And is that because the association, the league, is like, we need to protect our quarterbacks, or is it specifically saying, hey, with this one individual guy, make sure that he's untouchable?
Now, I'll get to the question. Just want to say something first about that. Last night's game, I can't say there were too many flags regarding that specific situation.
No, but that's been the case for the season.
It has been the case for the season, and definitely certain quarterbacks get a little more leniency than others when it comes to those flags, but it's really universal. I would say all quarterbacks kind of get the same amount of calls. Actually, Josh Allen actually got more roughing the passer calls called against like defending players than Patrick Mahomes this year. The interesting thing with these flags I found were taunting. And there's one play at the end where the Chiefs scored a touchdown and the safety that was on the Chiefs player, no thanks, Sam, tackled him. I you know what? I forgot we're not like, no one can see us. Yeah, no one knows
to do this. Guys, we're sponsored by Diet Pepsi today. Kyle and I each have a liter of Diet Pepsi. We're carcinogen maxing in some ways. But anyway, Adam, please continue.
Yeah, Sam's just been generously sharing it. Much appreciated, brother.
Yes, he has. We appreciate it. He's trying to take my mind off it and distract me from the devastation. Yeah,
by giving him more energy with caffeine.
Yeah. So essentially he got tackled in the end zone. Travis Kelce didn't like it. He came up, started taunting the player. Bill's player comes in to defend his player that's getting taunted. Travis Kelce flops, flag against the Bills. He ended it. He didn't start it. He was the only one that got the flag. I mean, like, I guess that's a thing of, like, you see that in, like, everything in the world. Like, just, like, the reaction is what gets the penalty. Yeah. And I just think that seeing that, I would have loved offsetting penalties there. Like, you call a flag on Travis Kelce for the taunting. You call a flag on Jordan Phillips for the taunting. But, like, that's the thing. Like, when it comes to those situations, the Chiefs get more of those.
Yeah.
That's where I see the bias.
Yeah.
I don't know what you do. You want the Bills to start taunting first and then the Chiefs get involved? Like, the Bills were just a little more disciplined team, and I honestly think it hurt them a little bit.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I don't know if that makes any sense. Because
it does. I mean, I get that a lot. In hockey, that's a big thing. Usually, like, if you know, it's good to be disciplined. You want to take a lot of penalties. But at the end of the day, like, if you don't throw the body and all of a sudden you get, like, destroyed, and then you throw the body and destroy someone else, the second guy's always going to get the penalty for charging every time.
When I think of this, I think of the recent Connor McDavid high-sticking to the face.
Yeah.
I think Connor McDavid was completely justified in doing that. Evan Bouchard got that to the face. That was not justified, what Tyler Myers did to Evan Bouchard. And I know that's maybe, like, protecting the stars or whatever. You're like, okay, an eye for an eye. But that was frustrating. McDavid was frustrated, and honestly, was it Garland that got hit?
Yeah, Garland.
Garland embellished that so much. I don't think he actually. I honestly think it was a.
Well,
it
probably hurt a little bit.
I think not worth a suspension.
Yeah,
I think it was a penalty, not worth a suspension.
Yeah, it was a 5-minute penalty would have sufficed.
Yep.
Yeah, or honestly, a double major.
Like, I don't even think Myers really deserved a suspension. Maybe one game max.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I don't know. I mean, the other thing that's weird though is I feel like in the NHL, like in big moments like that, like I feel like there's more like justification. Like they usually kind of justify the call. Like it's not just like, yeah, that just didn't happen, and then it just like game just like starts going again, and then you're like, holy, whoa, like what just happened? Like that was like, you know, we just scored and just got called back, and there's no explanation, nothing.
Yeah, no, like there's so many times in watching football where I'm like, what was the deliberation that the refs just went and reviewed that? Because I'm sitting at home, I can see that wasn't a catch. So what camera angle do these guys have that is like mysteriously saying that it is a catch for them? Like I wish there was a little more transparency. I know, like I love it when the NHL, when like they show the replay, what the refs are looking at
and what
on the big screen. And then you can like, you hear the fans react like, oh yeah. Like they start like booing or they start cheering. Like they know the decision before it comes to fruition. Mm. And in the NFL, I can be like, oh yeah, that's not, yeah, he got the first down, or like, oh yeah, that wasn't a catch. And then the call is just complete opposite of that. I'm like, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I think
that
in the
NHL playoffs, there's usually less like penalties and calls in the playoffs compared to regular season.
Yeah.
Would you say, Adam, that it's like the opposite in football where there's more of those calls in the playoffs?
I feel like the games feel more controlled by outside influence in the NFL playoffs than in the NHL playoffs. I was going to say that actually. Like in NHL, I feel like they let the guys play. Like, you know, like you don't really want to make it all about
you. So then
you.
It takes out the opportunities for it to be like, oh, there was so many bad calls because they're just calling less in general. Obviously, that can have its own issues, but it does just bring like the relevance of like the reffing out of the final result of the game more. Yeah. Where if you're having a bunch of calls or even the same amount